saw the bloke who invented 5.1 sound present once, he started like that, just with that music. And I just thought, all presentations must start like that. It kind of just feels like something's beginning. I've never found an equivalent ending. Whenever I get to the end of a presentation, there's a phrase that goes round and round my head like a tune, which some of you... How many of you are over 40? Put your hand up if you're over 40. Yes, my people. It's a phrase that I first heard in 1981. Take you back to those days. The SDP kind of rump had just left the Labour Party. And Labour and the Conservatives were both deeply unpopular. And the SDP and the Liberals formed an alliance. And at one point, in 1981, they were polling at over 50%, kind of people saying they would vote for them in the next election. And that year, at the Liberal conference, David Steele ended his speech like this.
Mr. President, I have the good fortune to be the first Liberal leader for over half a century who's able to say to you at the end of our annual assembly, go back to your constituencies and prepare for government.
I mean, and it's clearly among one of the most deluded things ever said, but it just feels right, feels like the ending, and I've never worked out an ending like that. Does anyone know what that is? It's that size, if that helps.
Cocktail stirrer.
No. Good guess. I don't want to be rude, but no. All right, well, we'll get to it. People ask me, what is it that you do? I don't have a good answer. I worked in kind of marketing and advertising for thousands of years. Did things you won't approve of. But I think I saw, I always say, I can't remember where I saw it. It was at Vauxhall. I saw this sign, it spoke to me. I think that's what I like to do. I try and get to the front of the train. I like hanging around at the front of the train because it's less crowded. The interesting people at the front of the train and, it's less crowded. Broadly, what I try and do is kind of get front of train. What I'm going to talk to you today about is front of train. I'm not advocating quit your jobs tomorrow and follow me kind of thing. And it may be the wrong train, so it's kind of worth bearing in mind. But that's broadly kind of what I'm talking about. And careful study of your notes will say it's kind of broadly this idea of post-digital. I kind of want to talk about sort of what I mean by it, some aspects of it. I want to talk about some of the implications I think it has broadly and why it's coming about and why it's interesting, and some experiences we've had with building kind of prototypical post-digital products, and then, what that means, blah, blah, blah. I'm sort of conscious it's the end of the day and stuff, so I've, just put interaction design jokes in. And stuff, and stupid videos, and so it should go relatively quickly. First aspect of what I think I mean by post-digital is increasingly we're getting real objects in the world with digital identities. This is from a lamppost in Gateshead. And it has a digital identity, and you can report it via its digital identity. And increasingly, objects are going to get digital identities. I think one of the byproducts of that is going to be bubbly writing and objects talking to you in the first person. It's just going to happen. There's going to be more and more that say, hello, I'm a toothbrush. We're just kind of, as designers, we're going to have to deal with that. Second aspect, I think, is digital stuff being expressed in physical things. I think, again, because I'm amongst you people, I can say canonical. I think the canonical example of that is Bublino. Do you know Bublino? Anyone seen this? This is an Arduino connected connected to a bubble machine connected to the internet, watching Twitter. And if it hears its own name, it blows bubbles. And Adrian, who built it, you know, and he takes it to conferences, and you can do the conference name, and, you know, if you see the conference name, it blows Twitter. It blows bubbles. And I think this is like the mother of all demos. This is like the mouse pad, or, you know, the mouse. This is an Internet of Thingsy thing. I think this is really, really important, because there's something here where the act of blowing bubbles is very closely a kind of physical analogue to Twitter. You know what I mean? The kind of the digital thing and the physical thing are really closely aligned in a kind of way that we understand. It kind of makes sense somehow, the connection between these two things. I think it's really done well. And the fact that it doesn't say much, but it says that it's there and it's saying things, I think it's brilliant. And I think Adrian has built brilliant, and he's building brilliant and important things, but he'll never build anything better than this, even though it's really silly. And you'll see it at conferences. You'll see this sitting next to some massively impressive touch interface thing, and everyone's trying to get it to blow bubbles, you know. So. And then, again, as designers, I think you're all going to have to get used to the fact that the surfaces you design are migrating out into the world. Every architecture student designing everything at the moment is building a digital skin onto their building. You know, buildings are going to be draped in digital skins. And I think the real downside of that is it will be horrible, because at the beginning, when they first, you know, launch the project and we've got a new civic centre for Brighton and it's got a fantastic digital skin, like, for the first 3 years, it will have, like, unsatisfactory media art all over it. But then someone from Coca-Cola will turn up and say, can we put a massive logo on there? We're like, no, we'll give you £1 million. Well, yeah, you can. I've said before, I think the possible vision is kind of Blade Runner brought to you by the makers of Silit Bang. You know, kind of just all over the world. But I think the really important bit of this is I think we're getting to a moment where we're finally overcoming kind of twin tectonic forces, which is, on the one hand, kind of digital infatuation, that everything digital is better than everything analog, and that everything new and shiny and screeny and touchy is better than everything analog. And equally, that kind of lead pencil club kind of analog, you can't read it in the bath, kind of, you know, everything printed is better and everything on paper is better, blah, blah, blah. I think we're getting past that moment. And we're getting people who are prepared to evaluate both sets of technologies and combine them together in interesting ways. And again, I think the best example of that is this thing, Things I'd Rather Read on Paper, which is a guy, I think, in Dublin, who works for Google, called Emmett Connolly, I think his name is, who, you know, on Instapaper, kind of bookmarked all this stuff and realised he would never read it. So just turned it into a PDF, sent it to Lulu and made a book of it. And you'll read stuff on paper that you won't read on screen. And that kind of combination of print and digital, I think, is going to be really interesting and kind of useful. So that stuff led me to kind of this kind of overblown and portentous phrase, which I stuck as the title of the talk, because I came here 2 years ago and saw Tom Coates talking about web data, and I came here last year and saw Matt Jones and Matt Bidoff talking about the kind of coral reef, and this idea that the web is being transformed from a thing of sites to a thing of APIs and services and things like that, and that, you know, you're moving to a place where, you know, you need never visit Doppler to use Doppler. You can use it via all kinds of other things. And the thing that seemed interesting to me is that we're hopefully moving to a world where that web of data will migrate off the screens and away from the devices and into the physical world. That seemed like an interesting thing. So that's what I wanted to talk about. My problem kind of being is I have absolutely no intellectual foundation to do that whatsoever. They've got degrees related to what it is they do and stuff. And I don't know what orthogonal means. So there's kind of, you know, my qualification for being here is I can put video in PowerPoint. So I went looking for, like, intellectual salvation, and actually, coincidentally, I found it. I was on holiday, and we kind of went to visit Harvard, and on the shelf in a bookshop, kind of like singing to me, was this. That's the over 40s laughing there, to say. Which I just kind of devoured, and I would recommend it to anyone. Some of you probably it will seem like kind of really naive or something, but I don't know. I haven't read many books about technology, but to me it just seemed really useful in explaining, as it says, kind of what technology is and how it evolves, how it changes, and things like that. So I've kind of used that to frame some of my argument here. I should also say, if you're one of those people who don't like, you know, like books with the pages folded over or notes or anything, you should look away now. He takes on kind of what Schumpeter thought about the evolution of technology, which is kind of that notion that kind of producing innovation in technology is by combining previous technologies. That all technology sprang out of previous things and it gets combined into new things. And putting those things together in new ways provides the next kind of wave of things. He also quotes this guy, Ogben, who talks about, actually, in a culture where there aren't many technologies, you're unlikely to generate many more. You know, you can't go directly from the Stone Age to the jet engine kind of thing. There's kind of a movement of technologies, and the richer the technological environment, the more invention kind of there may be. And he talks about the idea of a domain, so that technologies that kind of tend to work together and tend to get used together kind of cluster together into what you might call a domain. He talks a lot about kind of the development of aeroplane engines and jet engines, things like that. You say, you know, combinations of pistons and turbines and all this kind of stuff create clusters of technology which kind of find their peaks every now and then. And he talks kind of a lot about aero engines. And, you know, an example of this might be kind of the Rolls-Royce Merlin, which is kind of what found its way into the Spitfire.
Tell me where to start. Speaking.
Okay.
Speaking?
Yep.
On the 5th of March 1936, the Spitfire prototype, K5054, made its first ever flight from the Supermarine Works at Eastleigh in southern England, heralding the start of a legend that is just as powerful today as it was during those dark years of World War II.
And I think I kind of think we've lived through some equivalent kind of domains that have triumphed massively. You know, kind of who is the superhero of this kind of technological era? It's you. You know, it's kind of if you look at the kind of the massive success of the web, followed by then, you know, kind of the huge success of social networking. It's kind of two massive technological and kind of social things which have been hugely successful, really dominant and kind of dominated lots of culture. But I just realised there's loads of military references in this. I apologise for that. I think it's because I've got a 9-year-old boy. We were watching The World at War the other day. And thinking about success, there's a sequence where they talk about the French construction of the Maginot Line and how the kind of French were basically, you know, planning to refight the First World War, which, you know, they'd done well in. There was a kind of, you know, they were massively complacent about, you know, being able to turn back the Germans and kind of, you know, defeat and all that kind of thing. And there's a brilliant little moment where a French general talking about this.
We suffered from an illness which is not peculiar to the French. The illness of having been victorious, you know, and believing that we were right and very clever. A victory is a very dangerous opportunity.
And I kind of wonder about that, about the web and about social networking and stuff. It's like we've been tremendously clever, and, you know, that's really dangerous. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, well, how? We can do it. You know, you often meet internet people and go, yeah, surgery? Of course we can do surgery. We've got the internet, you know? We'll just bring that along. And yeah, you know, it's kind of, there's that a kind of hubristic thing going on, which I think I kind of even feel at the moment. It feels like French before the Second World War. I might be stretching it a bit. And there's another thing he says, which I think is really interesting. He says, one of the things that goes on with technology is, as a general rule, kind of, what starts as a cluster of things, that get put together because it kind of works, and they tend to get put together more and more frequently. They become a single unit. So a collection of parts becomes a turbine, and that, people know what a turbine is and refer to it, things like that. Blah, blah, blah. And that just reminded me of another thing that works that way, which is a cliché. Because the origin of the word cliché is the set of letters when someone was typesetting that they didn't bother taking off again because they used them so frequently. So a set of words and letters would be used so frequently that they didn't bother dismantling it. It became a cliché. And I kind of wonder again with technology whether this stuff is becoming a cliché. And I think one of the clichés that we're facing and dealing with at the moment is the screen. I mean, they are just getting everywhere. As Timo Arnell says, we have a future surrounded by glowing rectangles. Many of them kind of... And we don't really know how to design for them. We don't know, how to write for these screens. There are some that we kind of go, that's fucking cool, I'll have that. Obviously, this brilliant quote at the beginning of the article where it says, in trials, rabbits have been able to wear them for up to 20 minutes. Okay, were the rabbits pleased? Did they enjoy the services being provided? Or there's this.
Greetings, distinguished reader. I hope you're enjoying the current issue of Physics Today. This remarkable piece of technology you're looking at represents a revolution in the distribution of scientific knowledge.
Obviously, that's what's going to save magazines. Turn them into screens. They even got to the point now where you can get a screen in a Kinder Egg. And I was thinking at this point, would anyone like a Kinder Egg? Because I've got loads of them. Would you like to distribute these? And that seems bad to me. Another little bit of video, which is quite long, but it's both kind of simultaneously gripping and appalling, which is a kind of simulation of best title for a video ever, I think. Drone controllers execute hellfire strike, which is two UAV controllers in Nevada. It's a simulation, unfortunately, but two UAV controllers in Nevada. Blowing up a van in Afghanistan.
Hey, Shade 2-2, cleared off target.
Sister, you can break lock on the bridge and lock up the target 5 with tail 107.
Roger.
And we got 60 degrees more of hitting.
Copy.
Pilot, Sentinel, request weapons loadout.
Sentinel, pilot, I've got 8 missiles and 2 bombs on 2 Predators in the target vicinity.
Target 5, leaving building, entering pickup. Pickup now has priority.
Pilot copies.
Sensor copies.
Pilot, Sentinel. Expect to be cleared hot on our way pickup.
Pilot. Sensor, let's spin up a weapon on tail 107.
Copy.
Pre-launch checklist.
PRF code.
Entered.
AEA power.
On.
AEA bit.
In progress. Passed.
Weapon power.
On.
Weapon bit.
Passed.
Code weapons.
Coded.
Weapon status.
Weapons ready.
Pre-launch checklist complete.
Pilot, Sentinel. You're clear to engage white pickup truck at your discretion.
Pilot clear to engage white pickup truck. It's like it's on the move. Launch checklist. MTS autocrack.
Established.
Laser.
Laser selected.
Go ahead and arm your laser.
Laser's armed.
Master arm is hot. Go ahead and fire the laser.
Lasing.
Within range. 3, 2, 1, rifle. 3, 2, 1, impact. Excellent job.
Well, excellent job is the most chilling words I've ever heard, I think. It's kind of... there should be more juicy feedback in that, don't you think? It's kind of... And I think there's something... I'm not going to deny that screens can capture the imagination and you get involved and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I'm not anti-screen. But I kind of think there's also something there about the way a kind of screen, that's showing you the real world. Kind of, there's a reduction in affect somehow. There's some kind of sense that there's something between you and the world somehow, and that adding screens to the world may not necessarily kind of be to our good all times. I don't know if this will work, but I was kind of, it feels like that a bit. You know what I mean? Kind of people walking around with their devices held up. It kind of, there's a distorting kind of filtering effect somehow, which, you know. So that was the thing. And there's another aspect of this which he talks about, which is what happens over time is as these clusters and domains of technology evolve, things get added on. So this bit doesn't work, so we add this bit, and this bit adds on. So that, you know, we need to add this and we need to that. And it kind of gets more and more perfect. He talks about deep structure. But it also kind of, over time, also gets limiting. And it gets to a point where you can't break out of that technological domain. And it gets more and more constrained and that kind of thing, and kind of more and more hard to break out. Although it's working really well, you keep adding technologies and it stops you breaking out into new places. Which brings me back to this thing. Has anyone worked out what it is? It's not, obviously, it's not a jet engine. It's a thing. You know when you get a cup of coffee, like to take away, and you get the lid on it, and there's a little hole in the lid. What sometimes happens is the coffee spills out of the hole in the lid. But you can take one of these and put it in the hole in the lid, and it will stop the coffee spilling out of the hole. And that is not the only technological solution to that problem. There's also this. And I look at that, and I don't know why, but it says tweet deck to me. It's kind of, I can see why you'd have it and stuff, and, you know, it's solving a problem. But it's kind of, you know, applications built on Twitter, it's kind of, it's like, you know, there's no way of escaping that. You know what I mean? It's kind of, and I think a lot of stuff on the web and social networking at the moment is kind of trapped in this thing of like solving the problems that we are causing. You know what I mean? It's kind of, it's like this. It's like coffee tech. And the coffee cup lid industry can't escape from this kind of loop they're stuck in, although the Solo Traveller Plus is obviously making a noble effort. And what Arthur talks about is that the way out of this, technologically, is what he calls redomaining. So it's about going, finding another domain of technology and using components from that domain of technology to solve your problem. So not kind of iterating in the place that you are, but trying to find new things and introduce them and bring them in. And again, he talks about in the jet engine, innovations like fly-by-wire kind of change completely what planes could do. And not just solve the existing problems better, but unveiled kind of new possibilities for planes. He talks about how on the Pegasus, the Rolls-Royce Pegasus engine, new ideas about configuration of engines kind of made new things possible, like the Harrier, for instance.
A lot of
I'm not going to flinch. I'm going to look. Oh, my God. Don't say that. Scare me.
You want to be scared, Trev?
Yeah.
Shit, you want to be scared. He's gone down.
Look, mate. Fucking hell.
I think, and I, again, I was watching Arthur, the Engineering Britain's Super Weapons, which is a brilliant programme, and they had a little sequence about the Blue Streak, which is Britain's ballistic missile programme, up in Cumbria, where, because Britain's too populated to actually launch ballistic missiles, they built Blue Streak, and then had to test fire it by strapping it down. Because it couldn't actually take off, so they had to kind of they would test fire it, but make sure it was bolted to the ground, so that it wouldn't, you know, cause any damage and stuff. And
a space base had sprung up in the Cumbrian bogs to harness the power of the Blue Streak missile. Pinned to its concrete stands and caged in its metal towers, the rocket's mighty Rolls-Royce engines thundered.
You just look right into that flame, and that was very exciting. What about the coolant? How are you going to cool this fantastic flame area? Oh, thick steel, and the flame would just go right through that just in seconds. 36,000 gallons of water a minute had to be pumped up to that stand to quench this flame that was coming out of the thrust unit. Brilliant.
And I just think, you contrast that with the drone operators in Nevada, kind of excellent job. You know, I think that's why there's an appeal to me in kind of, embracing kind of physical stuff in what we do. I think there's something interesting in that kind of raw emotion you get from physical things. And it was interesting seeing Brian's presentation, then a tweet from Matt Jones, kind of also made me think, maybe this is a kind of peculiarly British kind of reaction to this stuff, because I didn't grow up watching the Jetsons. I grew up watching Thunderbirds.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Thunderbirds are go.
Flying car. And if we accept, and I think it's valid that there's a kind of there's a dialogue between design and science fiction. I think that's fair. I think you also have to accept that there's a difference between growing up in a culture kind of that's dominated, you know, with a childhood media culture dominated by like flat, colourful, 2D Hanna-Barbera cartoon, and grow up in a culture dominated by kind of hyper-realistic 3D models of the space future with greebles and blah, blah, blah. You know, kind of, I think that's different. And that might produce a different science future. We grew up with different engineering fiction, and that might produce different futures. And I just kind of think that's interesting. So anyway, now we have an interaction design joke. Has anyone seen Monsters vs. Aliens? Have you? You'll probably know this if you haven't. I now present interaction design joke.
At this rate, the Earth only has about 2 weeks left.
If that thing walks into a populated area, there will be a major catastrophe.
We need our top scientific minds on this. Get India on the phone.
Can we transport the United States to a safer planet?
I say we give this alien a green card and make him proud to be an American.
Sir, it's dire times like this when I stop and ask myself, what would Oprah do?
Hang it all. What's the point? It's a disaster.
Stop!
That button launches all of our nuclear missiles.
Well, then which button gets me a latte?
That would be the other one, sir.
What idiot designed this thing?
You did, sir. Fair enough.
Wilson, fire somebody.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
So I'm going to talk now a little bit about our kind of personal adventure in this stuff. Around end of last year, I found out kind of just through conversation how cheap it is to print newspapers. It's astonishingly cheap to print newspapers. And working with a designer friend of mine, my kind of design partner, Ben, we thought it would be nice to make something for everyone for Christmas, like for our friends. Why don't we take like stuff that they've written over that last year and reprint it as a newspaper and make it a gift for everyone. We'll print up 50 and it'll be nice. And we started with kind of Dan Hill's kind of canonical, again, Street as Platform post. We thought, well, I bet no one's actually ever read that. You know, it's kind of, you know, we've all looked at it and stuff, but we thought, well, if we print it out, people will actually read it. And probably it's about a spread. You know, in a newspaper. It's actually two spreads. We kind of thought, oh, that'd be interesting. And that actually is, that's just the first half. And so we printed it up and it looked really nice. We discovered we couldn't actually make 50. The minimum they'd let us print was 1,000. But it was so cheap, we just thought, we'll print 1,000 anyway. So we gave them to all the people whose blogs basically we'd stolen. They were all not very nice about it. Then we just said, well, the other 1,000 we'll give away to people. It became quite popular. In making it, there was kind of quite a lot of, which frankly I had nothing to do with, interesting design decisions. So It's kind of hybrid of blog and newspaper design. It doesn't ape a newspaper particularly, and it's not just straight reprinting of blogs. It's kind of a hybrid of the two, and I think works in that way. And because one of the things you notice, for instance, is if you don't have something above that line, it looks weird. But it doesn't have to be the date. You know, you can have kind of all things up there. So we just put some tweets and stuff up there. The other brilliant thing is you suddenly get access to, like, industrial age technology. You go to these massive sheds where all they do is print newspapers. And they're fantastic technology. So we got to kind of press print and see this happen. It's fantastic. So we sent these things out. We just wrote a blog. We wrote a post. So we've got them. If you want them, you know, send us an address and we'll send them out. And it was January, actually. It was a good tip. Like, do stuff like that in January because there's nothing else to talk about. So it kind of got popular and more people wanted them and things like that. And it went out in the world. And we'd done numbered editions, which kind of made it popular again. So actually someone started a Flickr group to try and collect all of the one, you know, find out who they got them all. And it just kind of became quite interesting. And we realised it turned from stupid joke into interaction design. So we thought we should change the music. Because that's, you know, that's what interaction design sounds like. And then we got to go, and I had to go and do a talk at The Guardian, and I was trying to work out what the kind of implications of this kind of were for The Guardian. You know what I mean? This kind of this way that we kind of seize control of the means of production for ourselves, as it were, and kind of what the message was for a newspaper group kind of that was being sent by this thing and kind of being sent by the internet, as it were. And I thought, I'll try, how can I bring this home to them in a kind of persuasive manner? So I did this. And I kind of think that's it's like we've broken the newspapers, but your machines are cool. And I kind of think that's a message more broadly, to be honest, for lots of things. And in having that conversation, talking about that, we kind of thought, actually, maybe there's a business in this. Because the reaction to this printed thing was so positive. Because it's just a newspaper. I mean, people have seen newspapers before. But the kind of reaction was incredibly positive. So we actually went to 4IP and said, we think there's a business in building a tool that will let people kind of curate and edit their own newspapers so that they'll be able to curate their own newspapers online, and we'll do deals with printers that they can, you know, print, communities can print their own newspapers. And hopefully that will actually reinvent what newspapers are. It won't just have to be things of news, but it can be things of photography or it can be whatever it was. And 4IP were brilliant, and there are a couple of them. And they just kind of really positive. And I would urge you, if you've got an interesting idea, to talk to them about it, because they're just very supportive about this stuff. And also, we may be approaching peak 4IP, so it's kind of, you know, worth slamming in an idea, they're really interesting way of funding stuff, because this is not an idea we would ever have gone to conventional venture capitalists with, but somehow I think they're exactly the right people to do this. So, you know, talking to 4IP, suddenly we're in the world of Channel 4 and all that kind of stuff, thought we should change the music again. So we're kind of in beta at the moment, trying to do various things. We're doing bespoke newspapers for little projects at the moment. Kind of the full program hasn't rolled out. But it's been really interesting, again, to see what people have done. This was a project we did for the BBC, who'd commissioned a bunch of really interesting kind of essays and thought pieces and stuff. And, you know, it was all online, but they wanted a way to get it into people's hands and distribute it. So we kind of made a newspaper like this. This was a thing of friends of ours, James Bridle, made. For a thing called Book Club Boutique, where, again, it was a festival, and it was kind of a club, a literary kind of club night in a pub, And they were all going along to another festival, and they wanted a thing to be able to distribute, so they kind of made a newspaper up and did it like that. This is the thing we did for Penguin. This is the first half of the new Hitchhiker's Guide book, which they wanted to use as a preview thing. And again, the newspaper just seems like an interesting format. And I think what this is showing is, if we give the tools to other people, they'll kind of reinvent kind of newspapers for us. So that's going on, and hopefully something interesting will happen out of that. But we are starting to learn a few little lessons out of it. So I just thought I'd close with kind of what some of the implications of some of that, I think, mean. We discovered newspaper printers, and at the point we discovered them, like, the newspaper industry is withdrawing rapidly, from those things. There are these brilliant infrastructures. There are these brilliant machines lying around the world. And, machines are not evil. Kind of what you do with them and who does it may sometimes be kind of wrong, but playing with machines is brilliant. And there are these brilliant infrastructures that have been abandoned. And just because a business is in decline doesn't mean it's not huge. The newspaper business is still massive. It might be in decline, but it's still massive. A great example is video, which, we all knew 5-10 years ago was going to be transformed by downloads. Video was going to become a thing which would be about download, would be entirely kind of frictionless, and would be entirely digital. And what's actually transforming video is DVDs through the post and vending machines. So Redbox in the States, is a machine where you go and get a DVD from a vending machine for a dollar. And that's actually what's kind of changing that business. And again, the postal system and vending machines, there are all these infrastructures out there that we can access. And the joy of digital tools somewhat is getting access to these infrastructures, not kind of bypassing them all the time. That's kind of interesting. Similarly, Timo Arnell pointed to this Gartner, the Gartner kind of hype chart, and pointed out that RFID is right at the bottom of the trough of disillusionment at the moment, and poised for kind of growth, I'd say. I mean, RFID is another thing that's like out there in massive numbers. There are infrastructures for RFID sitting out there in the world. Just because Navistag failed, we didn't take Minitel's failure as a sign that people weren't going to do computers. It's kind of... RFID, I think, again, has a huge amount of potential because it's out there, it's cheap, it's kind of easy. The thing you do have to watch when you've grown up in a kind of webby digital world is you forget about kind of some of the implications of analog friction. You can't just stick another server on it. You know what I mean? There are kind of all kinds of issues that crop up. This, for instance, come on, is... That's what 5,000 newspapers looks like. Because it's very easy, you print it, you go, because the cost difference between 1,000 and 5,000, not very much, to be honest. But 1,000 newspapers go in the back of a car. 5,000, you suddenly, so this is 5,000 newspapers in James's house. if you've suddenly, you're dealing with all that, like, physical atoms, you're dealing with stuff all of a sudden, and when you're dealing with stuff, there are other things you need to think about. There's delivery, there's infrastructure. Very often, the cost of getting something from A to B is higher than the cost of making it. So that kind of becomes a thing that you suddenly need to remind yourself of and think about again. And that kind of Arthur C. Clarke thing about sufficiently advanced technology indistinguishable from magic, that's obviously sort of true. But also, frankly, printing things out indistinguishable from magic. It's kind of like doing things in the real world. People think it's really hard. It's really, I find, at least, I don't know about you guys, but these days it's really difficult to impress anyone with anything on a screen anymore. You can spend millions on developing stuff and have the best thing, and you look at it on screen, you go, yeah, that's all right. It's kind of, because they've seen it all before. Like when someone finally launches gestural interface, in that kind of Minority Report, everyone will go, yeah, we've seen that. Whereas when, if you can actually make something appear in the world, people are genuinely impressed. People kept going, how do you print newspapers? And you go, well, you've seen newspapers. It's kind of... It's not hard, but it's actually not the act of it being... It's the fact that you've done it. It's the fact that someone, you know, an individual has done it. Someone they know has done it. And I think that's the big interesting thing that's going on at the moment. It's that's what happens here. It's like physical transformation is very impressive. I kind of think of it as the difference between kind of special effects, you know, watching a magician on telly versus kind of sleight of hand in front of your face kind of in the real world. And that's actually much more impressive. Doing things, physical things, is I think somehow much more impressive. Plus, there's a brilliant kind of magnificent grandeur to what some of these physical things do, which is undeniable about it's not kind of brought to you through this screen, it's brought to you kind of in this world. And it's just impressive. I still kind of get excited. And we still go and watch a lot of these things getting printed because, you know, when we press print, stuff like this happens. Right, running out of time. So I thought I'd try and sum up because I've really enjoyed all the stuff today, and I just thought I saw some themes kind of coming through. From all the talks, there does seem to be this notion that what people are often advocating is redomaining, is kind of finding some other domain and bringing it into the one that you're working on in order to inspire new ideas and kind of get new stuff out of it. And ideas, you know, of kind of from this to that will depend on bringing thinking from new areas. And that seemed really interesting. And I think Tom and I were trying to work out what we thought our kind of from and to is. And I think it's about from kind of representing the world on the web to kind of embedding the web in the world. That seems to be the kind of, maybe the redomaining that we're thinking of that I think is interesting about post-digital. We're starting with paper, because paper scales. You know, it's really easy to print stuff out. There's an infrastructure for printing stuff out. It's kind of, paper and printing is a really scalable kind of world. There are other worlds where you can do this as well. Some won't scale as easily, but lots of them will kind of work in the same way. And then the other thing I noticed is Adam used the word constituent. And I thought that was interesting. So if we think of all of these domains and kind of all these new forms of technology and things as constituencies, and then we think of kind of our goal to go out and master those technologies and those domains and kind of make the most of them and really kind of get on top of them, we could think of that as government. And then what we're able to say is what I would suggest to you all is what you should do is go back to your constituencies and prepare for government.